coming up? What's going down? What's coming to our town? It's gonna be good. Hope it don't flood. Oh, it's what's upstream.
Wow.
All right. Well, didn't that sound great? That was Ben Markle himself.
Yay,
okay.
It was the brand new version of our theme song.
Yeah, brand new version from July 19th, 2023.
First I've heard it.
So he, anyway, welcome to What's Upstream. This is your weekly Clear Creek County news show. I am your co-host, Mark Cuccinello, along with Lori Beckel. Good afternoon, Lori.
Hello, Mark.
Yes, and we have Chris Bradley in the house. Thank you, Chris, for being back. And Lou Howard, who, yes, we're so happy to have you back. Yes. Without further ado, Lori, I know we've got some housekeeping to take care of, but let me first say this is KYGT LPFM 102.7, 103.9 on your FM dial, streaming over clearcreekradio.com.
Yeah, Lori. So maybe we do have a couple of PSAs here, Mark.
Okay.
This is a great way to start a new year in Clear Creek County. There is a community gathering that will be on January 12th from 4 to 8 p.m. That's a Monday. It will be held at Sasha's at the Alpine up in Georgetown. Great pizza there. And it's for Project HOPE. HOPE is an acronym for Help Our Preservation Efforts. Come put the unity in community. Join in to listen, learn, and lead with like-minded individuals and environmentally focused organizations to get involved with our common causes, volunteering, donating, supporting, and coming together to protect and preserve the natural elements that make Clear Creek County so special for current and future generations. So again, this is sponsored by or hosted by the Friends of Clear Creek, a group that has done some excellent environmental work here in the county. And they want to hear from more people. They want to involve more people. And again, this is January 12th from 4 to 8 p.m. at Sasha's in Georgetown.
Yeah, it's on my calendar.
Yeah. I wish I could go. I'm on the CAC, and we meet that night, but maybe I can come afterwards for a little bit. There is an email here if you have questions, friendsofclearcreek@gmail.com.
Mm-hmm. All right. What else you got there? Should we do another? You want to wait?
Yeah, let's wait for this one.
Let's dig in.
Yeah, dig in. Digging in with Christine and Lou.
And we were just talking about what do we call this section, and it's, I don't know, it's just kind of history. It's a little bit of this and that. I got to thinking about oral history, and there was a professor at University of Houston named Willie Lee Rose, and she would say, tell what they say, but don't call it history. And it's it's a great, it's an interesting approach. Oral history is wonderful. Oral history tends to give you the personalities of the people.
And stories.
And stories. And you don't get them other places. But there are times that it kind of runs crosswise into those of us who read old books and find things. And just because Grandma so-and-so said it, you know, what do you do? So I was, when I wrote two books with Dwayne Smith on history of Georgetown, and the second one was on the 20th century, and when it was finished, a friend of mine from Silver Plume that said, well, will you do Silver Plume next? And I said, no, because you won't believe me. And he said, really? Well, he said, well, what do you mean? And I said, no, you won't believe me. It just, if it didn't start with Grandma Buckley, it probably wasn't real. And so it just wouldn't do it. what I found that I will read a little bit later is an interview with Grandma Buckley from the 40s, which is great fun.
Oh, wow.
Because when I found this, I was down at Denver Public Library, and I came across this article, and I just about was doing cartwheels. I mean, you know me, I couldn't do cartwheels. But even I was thinking of mental cartwheels because, hooray, I could say, yes, it was this way, and Grandma Buckley said it. Because really, well, if you think of oral history, I have an older brother. He's 4 years older than I am. We grew up in the same house. Our memories of town are completely different. Do you have an older, or you have a sibling?
Yeah.
And just, you know, we remember things very differently. So one of my favorites, see, well, the thing is with oral history is you can never prove it wrong.
Yeah.
It will always last. And one of my favorites is that Georgetown stole the county seat from Idaho Springs. And you've heard this one,
oh,
right?
Yes, we've heard that one.
Yeah. And the more elaborate people will say that Georgetown got the local militia to come down and steal the records from Idaho Springs and take it back. Well, there was an election.
You know? It was done democratically.
Yeah, it was done democratically.
It wasn't stolen.
No. I don't know if it was the middle of the night. There was no militia. There was a militia that formed an empire, of course. You know, what I mean,
yes,
you know, it's the personalities of towns haven't changed. There was a brief time period where there was a militia. I don't think they had horses. They had blankets, but they didn't come down and steal it. There was an election, but that's one that will never, ever, ever, no matter what I say, no matter how many articles I put out, how many places I put in it, it will never go away that it was stolen in the middle of the night. There was an election, and the election happened because there was silver mining on the west end of the county. And at that point in time, the population really switched. Mm. So early on, it was the basis of the population was Empire and Idaho Springs gold mining. And then with silver mining, everybody went up to the west end of the county. So they had another election, and it wasn't even close. But it's really a lot more fun to say, no, well, you know, they stole the election. They stole it in the middle of the night, and they came down.
Chris, excuse me, but mm-hmm. I want to comment on this oral history thing. When I moved to Empire, my mm-hmm. contact with the history of Empire mm-hmm. was through Wise history. Nelson.
Yes,
and,
yes.
And whatever Wise told me I mean, well, who am I to dispute anything he said?
And it's right, and it's good information. And so it's important to have it. And it's important to have someone collected who isn't me, because people will come up to me and say, oh, will you do it? And I say, you don't want me, because I'm going to have a real hard time saying, well, that's interesting. Not true, but it's interesting. And both are good things to have. And what you find in the local stories that somebody has to tell you are elements of the feeling of the past,
right,
and what it was like to live here that you won't get anyplace else. So really don't care as much about the this happened on the 22nd and this happened on the 23rd, which is more my end of things.
And things are shaped by perspective,
perspective,
you shared about you and your brother having different perspectives.
We just have different perspectives, but mm-hmm. it's important to have both. Mm-hmm. And one of my favorite from Silver Plume was the big town hall. And if you've been to the Melodrama up there, you've been to the big town hall. And George Rowe said that building was moved from the west end of town, from around Brownville, down to Silver Plume. Well,
I've heard that.
Yeah, right. It wasn't. The KP Hall was moved down from Brownville.
Hmm.
And yes, and it would have been fascinating.
Was Brownville?
Brownville was the west end of town. If you know where the Burley Tunnel is now.
It's still there.
Yeah, the Burley Tunnel is there, and Brownville kind of went from there further west.
Oh.
And at one point around the turn of the century, there were several slides that happened in that area, and there was also some new development, so there was a decision to bring the building down. That's the KP Hall. That's now the wonderful Silver Plume Coffee Shop, by the way, if you get a chance.
That was quite an undertaking. That's a substantial
building.
Think about
that. Yeah, it's a substantial two-story building and amazing. And I assume, I mean, I go back to my days on Lake Ontario when we would have, we would have little rollers that we called them, but they were the ones that you'd roll up. They probably used logs and would roll it across and down, and it would have been amazing. And that would have been amazing in and of itself. That one is real. The big town hall was rebuilt right after the fire. And I know that because there was an article in the newspaper that said Mr. Clare is starting to rebuild his property, which I thought was pretty good. And there was another article that said Mr. Clare has finished rebuilding his building, which I thought was pretty good. And there are newspaper articles and there are some photographs that show the building before the fire and the building that's rebuilt after the fire are identical. So chances of finding the identical building sitting down, you know, in the west end of town, not. And then I found a... I used to read weird things. I found a chattel mortgage on the building where he was taking out a loan for purchase of lumber for the reconstruction of the building. Now, those are, you know, two newspaper articles and a chattel mortgage. I could never convince George Downing. I could never convince him. He would say, I've been in that building, and it goes up against a stone wall. And I said, it's because they built an addition on the back. Well, anyway, the point is, it's wonderful oral history, but in that case, it isn't right. I've said it long enough and with enough emphasis, I guess, over the last 10 years that now people are starting to believe me. But I don't know that they will. Anyway, but along those lines, I remembered this article that I came across in 1940. It was written in 1940. I didn't read it in 1940. About the Kimberlin family. And they are the ones that I would say are the founders of Silver Plume, Charles Kimberlin and his partner, Colonel Ambrose Bartlett from Kansas. Anyway, I think that they started town. Well, if you listen to the oral history, it really goes back to the Buckleys and Owen Feenan and a bunch of others. So how could I?
How
really,
dare you?
How dare I convince us? I found an interview. It is an interview taken by Joseph Emerson. Yeah, Joseph Emerson Smith, that he did in October of 1940. Sagging Hotel was once center of a flourishing mining camp. And this was a whole series of articles that were done right around this time period of different places around the state of Colorado. And this was one that had the City Hotel, which used to sit next to the building that was moved in, the KP Hall. The dull boom of blasting high above and the nearer sounds of shrieking brakes and creaking harness as ore wagon crawled down the serpentine road on a Republican mountain, muffled Charles Kimberlin's voice, yes, as he tucked rugs around two of his motherless children in the wagon, piled high with household goods. Again he called, come on, Maddie, time to get going. The two small girls, big tears splashing their cheeks, clasped each other and said together, I promise, cross my heart and hope to die, to always send you a letter on your birthday and never stop writing, amen. Maddie, with a last kiss, left Alice and ran to her father. He swung her up on the seat with Ellen and Johnny, both older. As the horses started down the winding steep road, the three children waved to the forlorn little Alice and took a last glance at Silver Plume. Their father never looked back. In the mining town he had built and loved until now, his young wife had passed away with her babe, and there was nothing to hold him. The day was nearly 70 years ago. And so this was published in October of 1940, so this was about 1970.
1870.
Two remarkable women. Alice, Mrs. Alice Buckley, who November 8th will be 78 last Sunday in front of the sagging gray Silent City Hotel at the top of Main Street, told the story of the lifelong friendship of two remarkable women. Much happened to both. Maddie was to become the mother of Governor Ralph L. Carr of Colorado. Mm. Yeah. And by the way, yes, if you have been downtown Denver, close to the state capitol, you'll see the Ralph Carr, which is the state building. Right. Governor Carr was one of very, very few people who stood up for the Japanese in the time of Japanese internment.
Yeah. Right on.
Yeah. There's a monument on the top of Kenosha Pass to him.
Oh, okay.
And with that history.
With that history. Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, his mother was this Maddie, who was a good friend of Alice Buckley, who was known as Grandma Buckley. So like I said, I found this, and it was like, I am set. Okay. Alice, Mrs. Alice Buckley, who November 8th will be 17, da-da-da-da. Much happened to both. Maddie was to become the mother of Governor Ralph Carr. But before that, let Mother Buckley, blue-eyed and golden hair, with little white hands, soft voice and gentle, tell it her own way. I have to interrupt here. This is, again, you get to oral history. Monday was always the day for laundry. And there was something to be said for getting your laundry out first. And the competition between Grandma Buckley and Grandma Chapel to get their laundry out first. And I don't know which lady it was at the time. I have fortunately forgotten it. But one of them put out clean linen just so they would win. That week. Okay. Anyway.
Oh, God.
This old hotel, now owned by Mrs. Annie Elmott, who for years after the mines were closed and there was no new hotel, lived here alone, stands close to where Charles Kimberlin built his home. So their home was at what is now the town shop in Silver Plume at the corner of Silver and Main Street. Mm. Annie, I must tell you, stood up with me. Well, she was married. Okay. Pa brought us here November 1st, 1870, from Nevadaville. And again, this is Grandma Buckley speaking. I was 8, and the first little girl I saw at once made friends with was Maddie Kimberlin, 7. Within a stone's throw of this old hotel stood the Kimberlin two-story home of frame, and it was something of a wonder house, for it held the fine piano Mr. Kimberlin had had shipped by ox team across the plains. Mrs. Kimberlin was determined that her daughter should learn to play. Mr. Kimberlin owned Silver Plume, preempting the ground on which he laid it out and built it. I have Grandma Buckley saying this. I have Grandma Buckley, so they
must be true.
Yeah, must be true. All right. And he did. He preempted the ground for what is now downtown Silver Plume. The family were living in Georgetown in 1869 when rich ore was found 2 miles west of Clear Creek on the Bakerville Road. When more silver was found, Mr. Kimberlin came here, brought in lumber for building, put up a tent and a big sign offering a lot free to anyone who would build a house. Pa brought from him the ground for our house. I remember hearing how Mrs. Kimberlin and the 3 children, the first to play in this valley, helped found Silver Plume and piled the brush for burning after it had been cut by workmen to clear the bottom of the valley. Evenings, it was Maddie's privilege with a lighted candle to set fire to brush piles. But that forms the part of it that is the oral history that's great fun, that you remember that. The Kimberlins saw it spring like magic into a great mining camp. Mrs. Kimberlin died in childbirth, and not very long after, in 1873, Mr. Kimberlin took the children away to Rosita, a new camp in the Wet Mountain Valley beside the Sangre de Cristo Range.
There's something interesting. Rosita.
Yeah, Rosita.
Wonder if he established that, too.
He's very early at Rosita. Uh-huh. There's something strange about that Richard Irwin, after whom Irwin's Peak is named, and Irwin's Peak gets renamed Torrey. Who prospected here in 1865 with his companions, discovered the Senator Lode in the autumn of 1872, and that started Rosita. So Rosita, we'll put Irwin, who was here.
All those years later, she's still calling it by
the name that she wants because she remembers Mr. Irwin.
Oh, my gosh.
Many miners in this section followed Mr. Kimberlin to Rosita, among them Commodore Decatur, who named Silver Plume. Anyway, so I enjoy this. Kimberlin leaves early because his wife dies in childbirth, which is not uncommon at that time. But at that point, he is just heartbroken, and he's got 2 girls and a little boy, and he leaves. And at that point, they are taking care of themselves more than anything else.
And were you saying he left over by going over Republican Mountain?
He probably
That's the wrong
came,
direction.
Yeah,
to
he
Rosita.
Came. Yeah, he I don't know.
Sorry.
No, it's,
sorry.
Yeah, it, why would you go this way? In a, at that point, you'd go down and then up.
Yeah. That's a hike over that
way. It's mountain. A hike over that way. Maddie and Ellen made a home for their father at Rosita. One day he left for Old Mexico to try his luck. They never heard from him again.
Oh.
Bandits were murdering travelers, and the supposition was that Mr. Kimberlin had fallen a victim, and the children carried on. And so the fact that Kimberlin is not... does not stay here is one thing, that one reason people don't hear about him. And the fact that he dies pretty early is another reason that they don't. So
there's an interesting cemetery down there in Rosita that I've been to. And I wonder if any of these relatives are actually
I wouldn't be surprised. That
cemetery.
Oh, I'll have to go. So one of the other people there is Commodore Decatur. Became old and poor. He died in 1888. State wouldn't come to his relief, so Maddie kept him from starving, taking him meals she'd cooked from the scanty source of food the children had. She nursed him, sewed for him, tended his clothes, and finally laid him away. Ellen married and went to Cripple Creek, and after a while, Maddie followed. She married, and her son, Ralph, is Governor Carr of Colorado. Mm-hmm. Maddie, you remember, died last spring. We had promised each other the survivor would be at the funeral. I went to Denver for it. She wrote beautiful poetry, and each birthday I had a poem from her. Maddie Kimberlin was my dearest, oldest friend. I love that. So,
you know, people they didn't listen to podcasts. They didn't watch television. They played the piano.
They played the piano and they wrote poetry.
In founded towns.
Yeah. No, and it's wonderful. And again, this time period, the 1940s, they started doing these interviews of people around the state, which are wonderful. There's a series that were done by Joseph Emerson Smith that are published in the Front Range Mining Journal, Front Range Journal, in the 1970s, that are based upon the memories of Mrs. Hansen of Hansen Lodge. Now how?
There'll be some memories.
Yes, and there's some good memories there that we will do. So one other thing that he talks about in talking about Stephen Decatur. Stephen Decatur was actually Stephen Decatur Bross, and he went to Williams College for a couple of years. He's a very intelligent man. He was the he was editor of the Colorado Miner for a few years, and he was a real character. His motto was no monotony, no monogamy, and a third piece that I can't remember. But it gives you the problem. And he's either a wonderful character or he's someone who left two wives behind that you really sort of see, is this a good thing or not? He founded the town of Decatur, Nebraska, and other things. And he writes the most flowing, flowery, just wonderful almost, it's like poetry, that he's writing about different articles, different things that happened in town. And there was one where the then editor of the Colorado Miner, who was a fellow with the nickname of Snicktaw, which you remember, Mountain is named Snicktaw. Snicktaw, E.H.L. Patterson, who was a friend of Edgar Allan Poe. I mean, there's this wonderful early crew of folks that are out. Anyway, so you have the... you have Commodore Stephen Decatur, who's out here, and he's writing an article, and Snicktaw says of him, yes, he went, he fell in love as usual. he's a wonderful man, and he's a character, and he named the town of Silverdale, he named the town of Silverplume, and Mother, Grandma Buckley, talks about that here. Let's see. She tells epic story.
Chris, before you start, please, it occurs to me that there's listeners who might be new enough to Clear Creek County that they're not familiar with the impact of the Buckleys on the west end of the county.
Well, definitely so. And you're going to have the same here with some families that have been around for generation after generation after generation. And talking about oral history before, and my fear, you know, that I would write something that would say that this Charles Kimberlin was the first one that started Silver Plume, when obviously Alice Buckley was here real early.
Yeah.
To find her saying it. But the Buckleys have been around forever, and they've worked in the transportation business, and Grandma Buckley had 13 children. I mean, it's pretty amazing stuff. But you get their oral history. Then you also had George Rowe's oral history. Mm. And you had Grandma Chapel's oral history. And all three are wonderful. And all three don't always agree. Mm-hmm. And really, to be writing a book where I was going to choose one story over another, no. So instead, we will we will write.
Well, there's still a building in Silver Plume that says Buckley Garage.
Sure,
right?
There's still, yeah. There's,
and
there's still Buckley's.
Georgetown.
Yeah, there's still Buckley's.
And
yeah.
Still Buckley's.
There's still Buckley's.
Oh, they're
Buckley's and they're Buckley's and Haskins and.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, so anyway, so back to Grandma Buckley here. Her prize story is of the editor of the Georgetown Miner, Colorado Miner, Stephen Decatur Bross, for whose brother, Lieutenant Governor William Bross of Illinois, founder of the Chicago Tribune, Mount Gross overlooking South Park, his name. Stephen fought in the Mexican War, and after discarding the Bross in his name, and nobody understands why, he just dropped Bross and became Stephen Decatur. He came west, where he pioneered an eluded search by his family. He founded Decatur, Nebraska, before going to Georgetown. By the way, he forgot his wife and two children back there. Before coming to Georgetown, carrying with him his treasured sword, sidearms, epaulets, and uniform. He had the gift of extemporaneous poetry and named the new camp as he sat on a pile of ore being taken to the smelter at Georgetown in July of 1870, brandishing a bottle in his right hand and a sword in the left. The christening was in a rich baritone as he sang about the decadent present in contrast to days when plume knights jousted and gloried in peril for their lady's favor. The only knights left, he poetized, were the miners who took their lives in their hands in the treacherous underground caverns to bring the silver to their ladies' fair.
Silver Plume, that's where that comes from. I'll be darned.
And so he shouted to the echoing canyon walls, the new camp should be called to the honor of the modern knights, Silver Plume.
Wow.
Now, I will tell you that there was a Silver Plume mining company in 1869, which predates this. But I think that
that's a good story. Leave it
well,
alone.
Well, I think that he truly names it, and he sings it with that. Yeah. So he's one of the people that I put in the early category that gets lost sometimes in history. But he's wonderful, and at some point in time, someone should do a biography of the Commodore. But he ends up down in Rosita, where Maddie's taking care of him, and he is buried, I believe, in Rosita at the cemetery down there. Yeah, so you know where is the cemetery?
It's, well, there's not much of a town left in Rosita.
Yeah.
Outside of Westcliff.
Okay.
But there is still a mine.
Okay.
That's fairly. My relatives of mine used to live out
okay.
there.
Okay. And so, you know,
so
the area.
Yeah, we explored Rosita. Yeah. Interesting cemetery.
Well, it should be. And I wonder how many of these early folks leave from our area and go over there. And you get the feeling that there is, that the early explorers, the ones like George Jackson who mine here, they mine here for a little while, but then they take off. And yeah. George Griffith and Georgetown mines here for a little while and takes off. David Griffith stays, but he leaves for a while and comes back, and then he stays in Georgetown. But quite often, they are happiest where they are finding the original gold or silver loads and taking off from there. So Stephen Decatur.
Completely
anyway.
Different world, looking for a mineralization
yes.
and production. Of
and production,
yeah,
and especially the production
different.
Of main, you know, to have. It was one thing to dig a small hole. It's another thing to
sink
a
shaft.
Sink a shaft and have to go back east and come up with all of the investors
yeah.
and all of that. And you get a feeling that the early crew were a different crew indeed. So anyway, so Kimberlin, I believe, well, I know he stakes out a claim that is the town site of Silver, it would turn into the town site of Silver Plume. And he gave away claims to different people to build houses on it, and he built a school, started building a school and other things. So he was very, and you get the feeling that he was married to a wonderful woman, and she died in childbirth, which was quite common at that time. So mm-hmm. he packs up his two girls and his son and heads down to Rosita. Mm-hmm. And then shortly after that, he goes down to Mexico, Old Mexico, as they would call it. And is never heard from again, and they believe that he is probably killed by bandits down there. Maddie, in the 1880 census, is listed in Silver Plume as living with the Buckley, then Griffin family. She hasn't married Jeremiah Buckley yet. She's listed as living as a servant with the Griffin family. Griffin, I think it was Finan at that point. Anyway, I digress. So that's the first part.
Maddie was the child.
Maddie is the child, and she becomes
in the
mother. She's the child in the wagon. She is Grandma Buckley's very best friend, and they have promised that they will attend each other. You know, whoever lives the longest will attend the other's funeral, which she does. Mm. She attends the funeral of then mother of the governor, Ralph Carr.
And so he must have been born in Silver Bluff.
No, he was born because they leave when she is maybe 10 years old, 10, 11 years old.
Gotcha.
And they go down. I think he's born in, is it Pueblo, maybe Cripple Creek? Mm-hmm. He lives down in the southern part of the state and is an absolutely wonderful, principled man. The biography that was written about him was called The Principled Politician, the Ralph Carr story. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't have much in the way of connection to Silver Plume because he's born out of that. But I think it's a cool story.
Chris, yeah. You said something that piqued my curiosity. I've heard that the title given to people of a servant or housekeeper before, and that seems to be a common thing. I wonder if that was a convenience to call somebody that.
I don't know.
People were just taken foundlings use them as servants.
Especially at the point in time, at this point, by 1880. Her sister would probably have been married. Her brother would be old enough to be working at the mines, and she would be largely living at home alone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So she may well have worked just to help clean the house or something else. I don't know that servant is, I think it's that's used a lot.
A broader term that doesn't really mean what we think
what
it
we
might.
Think of, yeah.
Yeah.
Quite
right.
possibly.
Uh-huh.
And she doesn't stay for long because she has to go back down and take care of,
Stephen
Decatur until he dies.
Well, we're halfway through our hour already. That was a blink of an eye. But we're going to take a little breather for 30 seconds or so, and we'll be right back, folks. All right, we're back. This is What's Upstream. I'm your co-host, Mark Cuccinelli, here with Lori Beckel. Our guests today are the history ladies of Clear Creek County, Chris Bradley and Lou Howard. And this is KYGT LPFM 102.7, 103.9 on your FM dial, streaming over clearcreekradio.com. Lori, what do you got?
Well, this is the appeal we're making for all of you who love KGOAT Radio to help pay the bills. And so if you enjoy what you're hearing and you think community radio is worth supporting, please consider making a contribution to help us stay on the air. We are a pretty much all-volunteer operation here. We do have a couple of people. We try to put money together to pay and don't pay them what they deserve, for sure. But we really would like for people to think hard about making a recurring contribution And you can do so on our website, clearcreekradio.com. You can click on the Donate Now button on the top of the page and set up a regular payment of any amount. And any amount is helpful, right, Mark?
Oh, absolutely. Whether it's a dollar or $10, whatever you feel that you can contribute without even noticing. You know, that's the way I've always done it over the years. As I pick a number that I know isn't going to impact my finances in any way. Yeah. And I just signed up for that. And in a way it went. And it's been many years now. And I'd never even notice it. It just comes out. I want to say something about donating to the radio station. You become part of the radio community here in Clear Creek County if you do that, and that feels great to be officially a part of what's happening to support and sustain Clear Creek County and through the radio station.
This is an important institution here, just like Christine
amazing?
And Lou yeah. are important yeah. institutions.
Yeah,
I mean, think how long it's been that you've been doing the programs here. Well, just, I mean, would mostly Mozart even exist, without, but the combination of the programs and the amount that's said here, the different people that come and talk about one thing or another, it's great.
Let me just say this. I don't want to pump you up too high, but you guys are a treasure.
And
without the radio station, wonderful history of Clear Creek County would exist only on the library shelves.
Well, and it really is, it's a great deal of fun to do it this way, because while we have to, while it takes us time to research different topics, the difference between this and writing a tome, at this point in my life, I don't want to write another book, but I love doing short programs, and I think that they will be found by somebody who will pick it up later and do more. And you look at all of the research that you've done through the years on Idaho Springs, and I bet you could tell us about every person buried up at the Idaho Springs Cemetery.
Okay.
But it's to be able to do that online is wonderful, and thank you.
And our shows are now archived.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I know you get a lot of the information mm-hmm. from archives.
Yep.
But then these wonderful programs, these bits and pieces of
they
different
will last.
History, get archived on the radio station website.
The important, the critical, and the trivial. We cover it all.
True. So go to our website.
Support KGOAT. It's
Think
wonderful.
Think about making a recurring donation. You can even send a check, and there's information about how to do so there. It's a tax deductible contribution. Mm-hmm. Keep listening and help us keep community radio alive and well in Clear Creek County.
Yay.
Yes, and before we get back, one last, I'll take a personal privilege here, a shout out to my son-in-law who made a generous contribution over the holidays. Thank you, Eric.
Oh,
all right.
Yay.
Let's get back to the history of the oral history of Clear Creek County.
Oral and written.
Lou Howard, welcome back to the show.
Yes.
We missed you so much.
We did.
I miss being here. And this actually isn't oral.
Yes.
Oh, well, that's fine.
Yep. This is written.
But, so the thing is that we could do a lot of shows. We would never be able to cover all of the men and women, mm-hmm. because there were very prominent women in this county that made a difference here and made it what it is today.
Yeah. And they tend to be overlooked, a lot of them.
And they are.
Yeah.
And a lot of them are buried in mm-hmm. our cemetery in Idaho Springs. And so it's fun. Like George Jackson is not. But most everyone else is buried up in the cemetery. Mm-hmm. So I have done research on them because they're buried up there. But so today we're going to talk about Robert Birch Griswold. And all of these men and women were characters. They all had a lot of flavor. So it's so fun to do research on them because they just come alive. Yeah. And there's so much that you can learn from them. But he was always called Elder Yeah. And the reason he was called Elder, and there's, of course, two or three different accounts right. of him being why he was called Elder, but he sang loudly for church services, they said. And that, but the
and was
original,
he a Presbyterian?
Yeah. And the original story I'm going to read about in a little bit, because I'll just read from this one newspaper mm-hmm. article. But he was born in New York. So there you go, guys.
A lot of
and a lot of people that came here were born mm-hmm. in New York. But he was born in 1830, and he left home when he was 18 years old, and he went to Wisconsin, and he farmed there until 1861.
Out on the frontier.
Yes, yeah, yeah it was.
And that's where he met his wife, and he was married there. And that's where he ran, I believe, into Henry Plummer. And then he and Henry Plummer, who's another very yeah. prominent person that we could write a lot about mm-hmm. and talk a lot about, came to Idaho Springs.
Together, huh?
Together.
Oh, no kidding.
And I believe Matthew Cuttington came with them as mm-hmm. well. So anyway, he thought he was going to farm when he got here, and he so this is not happening. He sold all his farm equipment and bought mining equipment, but
he didn't do his research before he came.
Well, he thought they,
no, he knew he was going to the gold fields, yeah. and they knew that they could come here and make money. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't necessarily mining. Mm. You know, he yeah. thought he would still be farming, because to put it, he was a real estate man, he was a builder, he was a politician, big time. We call him a preacher just because when there wasn't a preacher, he was the preacher. And okay. he was a mine owner, and he owned a lot of property.
Okay.
So, but he was predated by Fayette, B.B., and Wilson E. Sisti, and a few others in the original town site here.
Okay.
And I was just going through a lot of property records trying to figure out, you know, when did they buy this? They didn't really buy the property. I cannot find records where they bought the property.
They just claimed it.
They just claimed it like yeah. a mining claim.
Uh-huh. Right. Yeah, right.
Mining claims they filed, but property claims, no,
they just built
a house.
Before somebody, if somebody or if the town site is platted, then you have to do it. But at the time that they get here.
But when they came here, it was not planted.
Right. It was just.
And he was, actually, they finally did a survey of the town. And this wasn't until 1873. So when you think about it, I tell everybody, the way you remember when Idaho Springs actually sort of started, yeah. the gold was right. struck, was 1859.
Right.
So just remember the 49ers mm-hmm. in California were the 59ers. Right. And so then you can always remember that date, and then you know it's right. nothing happened till after that, you know. So they were here early on, and they didn't file, do a survey and do all of that stuff until 1873. Mm-hmm. And Griswold walked to Georgetown, and he paid the money, which he collected from, I'm sure, from everybody else. Right. You want that lot? You got to give yeah. me the money. Came over, filed the claim. And then it wasn't actually granted until the next year. Yeah. And President Grant, it was chartered then. And so I found in Idaho Springs in their little records the taxes being collected in 1874. And I got to figure out how to digitize that or do something with that, because it names everyone what they owned.
Yeah.
You know, their horse, their wagon, right. their house on lot 10 or whatever, right. you know, mm. so they did that. He is the patriarch, and he did not stop there. He just kept going because he, you know, was the first mayor of Idaho Springs.
So I thought.
And yeah. in City Hall, they used to have a picture of him.
Oh.
And this is what all the men look like when you go back and look at the records. When you read about what they did, you think they're probably fairly refined. They are not. they are bearded usually. They wear work clothes because they they were industrious people. Yeah. They worked hard, and they made it happen. So they weren't just sitting around filing papers or whatever.
Right,
that isn't
right.
what they did. And what in 1880, I don't know if you've read about it or not, but that's actually when Idaho Springs kind of boomed. Mm-hmm. Everybody was coming here, and they didn't have houses. So guess what? Elder Griswold said, we got to build some houses here. And he built a lot of cheap little houses right. for people to come and live in.
There was a reason for that. they built most of the houses that were built were nobody thought that they would be here forever, you know, yeah. that their they weren't homesteading. They were here to strike it rich in the mines.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
and then they were going to leave and go someplace.
Else.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
he's one. But what interests me is we've got the 59ers that come out, you know, Griffith out west and George Jackson here. And really, they don't stay very long and they head out and it's pretty tight. Now, we haven't at some point we'll get into Empire. But, you know, there are a few people that stay, but not very many. So when you get the person like Elder Griswold, who comes here in the early 1870s, and with that crowd he's with, man, they're...
Yeah, he was 1861, he was here. Yeah.
That's and way back.
That's way back. Wow.
He died
in 61,
here.
Okay.
He died here in 1917.
Wow.
And he was 87 years old, and at that time he was the oldest citizen in the county.
Yeah.
Because you didn't live to be 87
no,
years
was
old.
Ancient.
It was harsh, the medical care, you know, everything.
Yeah.
But he was a tough guy. And he's buried up at our cemetery, and his wife and two sons are buried up there. And he didn't have a headstone. And it's always bugged me.
Yeah.
And Eleanor, his wife, it's spelled wrong on her headstone, but I can live with that at least. But she died first, and so he made sure she had a headstone. But I went to city council, and they actually, I ordered, and they paid for him.
Oh, that's great.
So,
nice.
Good job.
Yeah, so job. He has a headstone now up there.
It should be the biggest one up there, the most prominent.
Well, actually, the biggest one up there is Plummer.
Yeah.
Because he was very prominent.
Plummer and
that's what I mean. I know Chris has got a ton in Georgetown and Silver Plume.
Oh,
the histories that we could do on the men and women would just, I mean, we could never get through them all. There's so many.
We could start at one part. Just keep coming.
Yeah.
So Griswold, it sounds like he found ways to sustain his livelihood over the years, you know, right?
Well, he sold real estate. He did do that.
Uh-huh.
And, he was an opportunists, I would guess you would call him.
Entrepreneur, maybe.
An entrepreneur. And, I mean, Plummer and those men, what they did is they started up livery stables and they sold merchandise. And
that's, the Buckleys.
That is where they made the money. And that's why they stayed here, because they still had money no matter what.
Yeah. Was he gets called elder, and sometimes I think I've seen him as reverend. Was he associated with any particular church that you could
tell? No, I couldn't find that. They just called him Elder just Griswold. Because, well,
he allowed,
let me read this little article, because part of it has what he says. So it's a little bit oral, you know. So, because he was the first Idaho's first mayor, has helped to make the city famous. Elder Griswold entered the city for the people and has been years in the harness. Because he was a public citizen. He just did so much. At the banquet of the new and old council last Thursday night, there was present one individual who has been more than any other person identified with the municipal affairs of Idaho Springs. That man is R.B. Griswold.
Yep.
So a lot of times he also went by R.B. because they all did that. They all went by their initials. Hmm. Even the women went by their initials who were business women.
Interesting.
Elected last week to the office of police magistrate without opposition. Now, this was written in 1903, and this is after he's already been
mayor.
County commissioners, the city commissioners, judges, all of that. So they called him Judge Griswold, was not only the first mayor of Idaho Springs, but was mayor for 8 years and alderman for 5. Thus being one of the city's fathers for 13 of the first 18 years of the city's existence. Mm. Not another citizen has been so closely identified with the city's growth and progress, nor is there one here who has the incidents of the city's history so accurately in memory and at the tongue's end. So it would have been fun to talk to him. He said, yes, I was the first mayor of Idaho Springs, said Judge Griswold to a Gazette reporter. We were all appointed by the county commissioners at the request of the people by petition in 1873. Mm-hmm. So that's really when Idaho Springs was organized, you know. The Board of Trustees, as the body was then called, was composed of F.W. Beebe, Peter Theobald, M.O. Coddington, Hopkins Barnes, and myself. And all but Beebe are buried up there. Mm. And the other fellows chose me to be president. In such capacity, I entered the town of Idaho Springs in August 1873. That doesn't mean he entered here, because he came in 1861, but he entered as
being... He entered the plat.
In the city, In trust for the citizens, and received a deed from the government signed by President Grant. This deed is still in the possession of the city and will be preserved as a relic. Of the members of the first city council, Theobald and myself are the only ones left. And Theobald has a really big, big headstone statue up there. And Hopkins Barnes is much smaller. But Hopkins Barnes died on the 23rd of July, 1874. M.O. Coddington died in the spring of 78. And Beebe committed suicide in 1880.
Uh-oh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's, Beebe... There's a ton of stuff on BB.
We could do a lot on my favorite coroner's reports. Anyway, we don't need to get through that. That's fun, though.
The other city officers were D.A. Montague, clerk and treasurer, John A. Dory, constable, and Henry Plumber, supervisor of the streets. And they're all buried up there. And the Montague brothers were the ones who did the Hot Springs Hotel. Mm-hmm. So Montague, he was a younger brother of Harrison Montague and left here in 78. So David is up there, but Harrison is not. Henry Plummer died last year, as you know, and Dory still lives here. Had you ever held your present office before this time, was asked of Judge Griswold? Oh, yes. My first experience is when I defeated Hopkins Barnes for the office. Barnes was the leader of the Democrats, and they were almost all Democrats here at that time. There were a few Republicans, however, and I was one of them. We used to hold together pretty close in order to keep our organization up, but that was about all we were able to do. On the spring in question, I insisted on placing a full ticket in the field, including justice and constable. The result was that they made me accept the nomination for magistrate, and over a tremendous majority of the opposition, I defeated Hop, because that's what they called Hopkins Barnes, Hop, by over 40 votes. I served once after that in all 3 or 4 years. This is fun. I remember the first marriage ceremony I performed. I carried out the usual custom and kissed the bride, and she was a pretty bride, too. I went home and told my wife about it, and she made me pay over the $5 I had received for the job. Since that time, I've been very careful about disclosing official secrets.
That's
See,
awesome.
He's coming
he's
to
wonderful.
Life. He's coming to
he's
life.
Wonderful.
Right with
yes,
you.
Yes. Through his own words. That's great.
Judge Griswold is familiarly known to the people of the county as Elder. He gained that name not from his church associations, but from an incident which occurred in the early history of the country when a man died with his boots on. The people demanded that he should have a funeral, but there was no one to preach it. Griswold volunteered his services, and all went well till the time to sing came. No one knew the words of a religious song, so someone started a rival ballad, and everyone joined in. It answered the purpose very well, and ever since that day, the improvised preacher has been known as Elder Griswold.
Ah, that's wonderful. That's like Harry, you know, the number of services that Harry Heilman has done in Silver.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he's there.
And And Don Allen.
And Don Allen,
Don,
yeah.
Don.
When you started talking about this Griswold, I couldn't, my mind immediately went to, the booming voice, the physical presence of the guy.
Yeah.
Don Allen. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, that's fun. And I think, I don't know, just from the pictures, he looks like he's not a big man. Uh-huh. He looks like he's a small man, but I can't really tell. First chosen mayor in 73, he retained that office until 77. He was again chosen in 82 and retained the position until 86. In 87, he was chosen trustee and served until 91. I thought you'd get kind of more of him in that story.
That they are all still around. When I went to look at Georgetown, the first mayor was Frank Dobbin, D-I-B-B-E-N. He spelled all kinds of different ways. Mm. But he made it for 3 months. And then he stopped attending and someone else took over. The towns are so wonderfully different. But, you've got a crew in Empire that have been there forever, that were there forever, and the same with Idaho Springs and with Silver Plume. Georgetown's the one that turns around quickly.
Well, I will say that Mr. Griswold spent 13 years in the service of Idaho Springs at City Hall, and I spent 14.
Yeah, yeah.
I have a person who I used to know in Empire, an older gentleman who I became close to, Ed Theobald.
Right.
And Ed actually came to Empire from Breckenridge. He grew up in Breckenridge when it was a town of 200 people. Mm-hmm. And I don't wonder if there's some connection, family connection.
Oh, that's very likely, because a lot of times they came out and some of the family went south, and some of them, it just depended on, where there were opportunities. Mm-hmm.
He worked for Byron and with
Byron. Years. Byron and Ed were
good friends.
Peas in a pod, right?
And LaFerne was
her. Yeah, LaFerne. Oh my, she made the best peanut brittle. Oh my gosh.
That's what we ought to do sometime, is just say, remember, who made what. But I think it's important to remember these folks. We do remember the Jacksons and the Griffiths, but the folks that came here, as early as 1861 or 64, 69, 70, mm-hmm. and stayed here throughout the 19th century. They're cool guys.
And women. Because I have some great histories on women who made this town happen.
Yeah.
We must do a show on that.
Well, Catherine, I'd love to do it sometime. Catherine Skinner, she was an amazing woman.
Put it together.
Okay. We've done a little bit of the women, but there's more. There's definitely more of the women.
Yeah, there's
and
a lot of
Idaho
them.
Springs, you have, of course, the Social Ethics Club, which is still, it amazes me that it's been here for.
Aren't you a member of that?
No, I'm not, but.
I thought you were.
I'm too busy. I can't do it. I got too many things in the.
And in Georgetown, it was the Opera Club and the Students Club that were the big ones.
That show that we did on the clubs, I have found more clubs even since then, and we had a lot of clubs.
We've got to keep doing this program forever.
We plan to.
Lori, I wanted to ask you, I know your mom lives in Georgetown. I thought she did.
No.
I thought you had a family history here in Clear Creek County.
The only connection we have, my Fowler family has, is my dad was very much, he was a state senator and very involved in railroads.
Okay.
And loved, he's the founder, or the politician who founded the Cumbers and Toltec in Colorado.
Yeah.
But so he had a real interest in the loop and the Argentine Central and all of that. I don't know if you've done a program on the railroads, but fascinating history, and that's really my only connection.
Cool.
Well, we're running out of time here, and I just want to say that 2025 has been let's call it a hectic year.
It seems like we're coming into the end of it like, hey.
Yeah, it was exhausting.
Can we start again?
But 2026, we're gonna all do our best, like Mr. Griswold did, to make our community even better than the great community that it is right now. Yep. So that's one of my resolutions for the year, is to continue to make my small contribution. Yep. And I would encourage everyone to think the same. Yep. Get outside of yourself and do a little something for the community as well.
Support KGOAT. Go to the community gathering.
Yes.
Be kind. Be kind to everyone you meet.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you so much for coming in today, ladies. And I can't wait to one more show before I go to Italy in February, please. Okay.
January.
You go, and we'll have January show on schools.
Yeah, the January.
Right?
Yeah,
right.
And
the one
that we
had ton of schools. Oh, no,
yeah. Yeah. We're going to be doing schools. And it's a,
and our show actually next week is going to be on retirement and seniors. And we have Jada with the state coming in, and Donna Klein will be in with us next week.
Beautiful. I so look forward to that. First show of the year, we're going to get off on a big note.
On an old start. Oh, what do I mean?
Okay, ladies, thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to all of our listeners for tuning in today. We'll be back next week with more of the same. Don't forget, Morning with Mozart, 8 o'clock Saturday. See you then. Bye.
A ton
of them. Well, what's coming up? What's going down? What's coming to our town? It's gonna be good.